on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
The whole Western esoteric tradition is a mixed bag.
Right.
You've got Kabbalistic aspects that are mixed with a much earlier, to me, possibly Sumerian, Babylonian, Egyptian mysticism, and they were fully aware of this internal alchemy. I just want to emphasize that this is an internal alchemy. This is a psychophysiological alchemy that actually transforms the human body to be able to contain, to be able to handle the amperage, the voltage of cosmic consciousness. You cannot plug a hairdryer directly into a nuclear power plant. Just melt. And so that in the same way, you know, if you just start out saying, I'm going to merge with God, you know, I mean, who has the power capacity to handle that? So we work with the angels, archangels, the archai, the seraphim, until we build our power capacity to be able to handle the voltage of cosmic consciousness. That's how yoga came about. This is how Tai Chi, Qigong, everything is about preparing the body to be able to merge with higher and higher states of cosmic consciousness. Once you do that, once you develop that and you're actually, your internal circuitry changes, then miracles start to happen around you. Healings start to happen around you. Your divinations just start to flow out of your mouth.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth.
I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author Kevin Turner to discuss his book, The Secret Fire of Alchemy. Kevin shares how childhood spiritual experiences led him to Kriya Yoga, Tibetan Buddhism, and Shamanism. He describes the significance of spiritual initiations, out-of-body experiences, and the process of consciousness expansion. We explore the idea that all spiritual traditions aim for a connection with a higher consciousness achieved by an internal alchemical process. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Kevin Turner is the Director for Asia, a senior teaching faculty member and field research associate at the Foundation for Shamanic Studies. He was also a residential facilitator at the Monroe Institute for more than 12 years. Kevin has been a Kriya yogi since 1986 and was personally initiated by Swami Hari Harananda Giri, the last living disciple of Sri Yukteswar at Kada Ashram in Orissa, India. He has also received initiations and training in the Kagyu School of Tibetan Buddhism and has studied esoteric traditions across Eurasia. He joins me today to discuss his book, The Secret Fire of Alchemy, Kriya Yoga, Kundalini, and Shamanism. Kevin, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, I'm very excited to speak with you. I hope I did not slaughter any of the names in the intro. I know I asked you before we recorded, but sometimes I have mixed results with those.
The ashram is named Karar Ashram.
And it's Karar, okay.
Orissa State, which is now called something, Odisha State.
Okay, all right.
Back to the
Earth. Okay. Yeah, I haven't heard about that one. I know names change quite a bit there. So,
well, I kept with the original name because that was at the time that I was there.
Okay. All right. So your book is a fascinating book, and it seems to me that it operates on a couple of different levels. On one basic level, I think it would be fair to call it something of a spiritual autobiography. But there's a lot more to it, I think, than just that. But I thought that maybe the best place to begin for this conversation was to ask you to talk a little bit about your spiritual journey, because it's fascinating.
Thank you. Well, the book starts from age 21, but it actually started much earlier, probably since I was 4 years old. There was something in me that remained conscious through my deep sleep. Some people say that was because of previous spiritual work. It's hard to say. In any case, something was remaining awake in me. And then at age 21 started the more in-depth initiations in the dream state. Some people call these out-of-body experiences, astral projection, also shamanic journeys, but they were happening spontaneously in my deep sleep. And so later I discovered that these had correlations to the alchemists' descriptions, especially when they talk about dissolve the body and coagulate the spirit. This seemed to fit to what was exactly what was happening to me, where my body would become like stone, and then my spirit would exit the stone, as in the classic out-of-body experience. To me, it is now the same as middle world shamanic journeying, similar to astral projection as well, but it is all a part of a continuum of consciousness, a spectrum of consciousness. Ultimately, one could say we are the universe and there's no limit to consciousness, but typically we sort of coagulate a consciousness around a primate body, and we start to say, this is me. And so that's where the alchemical calcination comes in. This is where you're boiled down, or in shamanic terms, you're dismembered. There's no pain, but you're taken apart. In a sense, you're getting a software upgrade. The old software is being taken down, the new software is being installed. There's no pain involved, but to the old software, it might feel like death or being taken apart or being dismembered, literally, or burned to pieces. But then there's a new software installed and there's a new circuitry that can handle a new power capacity to merge with different states of consciousness, more at accelerated soul evolution, you could say. So this is exactly what the yogis in India are doing, what shamans have been doing, what the Taoist alchemists in China have been doing, in Egypt as well. So Carl Jung said that essentially alchemy is the yoga of the West, and yoga means to yoke your consciousness to the Godhead, or to merge your consciousness with a deity, which is the essence of shamanism as well. Shamans always say, I don't know, my spirits know. I don't heal, my spirits heal. So when you merge your consciousness with spirits, it's exactly the same as in yoga or in any of the meditative traditions, including Tibetan Buddhism.
So when you started having these experiences, like around 21, you started investigating to try to make sense of them. And did that lead you to alchemy originally, or did you have other avenues that you went down?
I did study Buddhism and Hinduism as well. It was when one particular, you could say, out-of-body experience shifted then into a journey back through the bardo. And bardo means between two. It's a Sanskrit word, and the bardo tadol is also known as the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So I passed through backwards through those stages just spontaneously, under the guidance of a spirit that just appeared coming through my ceiling. And the spirit gave me a name of my previous incarnation. I saw him laying in the bed from the ceiling, and I realized, oh, I died here. So this was a doctor in the 1800s in Eastern Germany. And so when I found out that he was real, I mean, he actually had a name and had even published books only in German. I found out that he lived at the same time as Goethe. And when I looked up more about Goethe, I found a book called Goethe the Alchemist. And then there was a whole passage of where I started to connect Kundalini, alchemy, and my experiences. Now, this was before classical shamanism that I studied much later.
Yeah,
So, of
because
course,
I'm sorry, reading the book, it seemed like the shamanic aspect came in much later than anything else.
it became an actually earlier and later, because as a child I was having shamanic experiences, but I had no context for it. And I'll but that'll be in volume two. Right now, this is volume one, Secret Fire.
All right. Well, I'll try to be kind and not ask too many questions about the next book, but I'm intrigued. One of the things I was curious about is you know, you've had that experience and you were having these, you know, what we would refer to as the out-of-body experiences when you were 21 that led you onto this incredible spiritual journey. And, you know, one of the questions that I had when I was reading this was, well, why him? You know, why did this happen to Kevin? Does this happen to the rest of us, do you think, that we just don't recognize the calling to the path?
Yes, it depends. I think that all of us are, or many of us, I can't say all of us, many of us have been working on particular projects across lifetimes. And it depends on the depth and focus and concentration and literally the spiritual vitality that you put into the trajectory of that project. And that will carry through lifetimes. And so even if you go way off the track for a while, you get pulled back by simply the power of that spiritual trajectory. So this book actually involves going back through four lifetimes working on the same project. And I finally, in a sense, reveal in the book what alchemy really is and what the Philosopher's Stone actually is in a way that, as far as I know, no one else has really spoken of.
Yeah.
And I compare it to Kriya Yoga. And if you read between the lines, many of the advanced techniques of Kriya Yoga are described, but the how to do it exactly is not there. You really need to receive the power transmission from a Kriya Yoga Acharya teacher.
Right. Yeah. So let me ask you, since you've mentioned Kriya Yoga, I always want to make sure that people understand the terminology. I think it's the mix of the philosopher and the teacher in me. I first learned about Kriya Yoga reading Yogananda's Autobiography of a Yogi. And I know that you mentioned that book a number of times in yours, but what exactly is Kriya Yoga?
Kriya Yoga is an internal yoga. It's similar to Neidan in Chinese, internal Taoist yoga. So it has nothing to do with the power yoga, hot yoga that you see these days. Yeah. There are some physical postures that you can do that will prepare the body to contain more spiritual vitality, more prana, the secret fire. That's what the whole thing is about, is really the kundalini is the secret fire.
Right.
But it is almost all internal. So the microcosmic orbit you might have heard of in Taoist alchemy, that's the start of Kriya Yoga. There's a second level. Third level, it moves into the brain and the cranium. And the fourth, fifth, and sixth all move into the center of the head. And so there are subtle chakras and subtle energies at the peak of the head, and eventually you are able to enter the breathless, pulseless state where there's no breath, there's no pulse.
Okay. And is that samadhi?
Yes.
Okay.
Nirvikalpa samadhis, savikalpa samadhi. Savikalpa samadhi, you are unable to move. Nirvikalpa samadhi, you can actually walk and talk and still remain in cosmic consciousness or God consciousness.
Right. Yeah. And you explained or described a couple of instances in the book, these experiences where you were having this like major altered state of consciousness where it's like beyond the individual, beyond the ego, and was still trying to seemingly still trying to function while in this state.
Right.
And
well,
you're
describing the mystic path, and it's not easy. That's why most people go into ashrams or into monasteries so that they don't have to worry about taxes and all that stuff or paying the bills. They just wash some dishes, meditate all day long, you know, and pray and wash more dishes and work in the garden. Because it's difficult to function in the outside world where you know, it's the rat race from chasing the dollar and all of that.
Right.
However, the shamanic path is interesting in the sense that in indigenous societies, most shamans have day jobs. I mean, they're hunters, they're farmers, they smoke fish. I mean, they do whatever. And they shamanize at night because they can't afford to support a full-time priesthood who's just sitting around praying. Everybody's got to work in order to survive. So shamans are really part-time mystics. They may merge temporarily into the all that is, into unity consciousness, But that the goal is not permanent merging. The mystic wants to permanently merge into the consciousness of a deity, want to permanently merge with the Godhead. Whereas a shaman does that on a part-time basis. They come back and they live a relatively normal life. I mean, some shamans are even rascals. You know, they drink and they smoke and they run around. But then when they shamanize, they merge with their helping spirits. They bring in the power. They do their healing and divination. And then when it's over, they release the merging. And then they go back to being a relatively normal human being. However, in time, they are transformed. So even the shamanic path will eventually pull a person toward the mystic path. So elderly shamans will turn more and more inward as they age.
Yeah. I can imagine merging consciousness with the deity would really make paying the bills very difficult. But it also, in my mind, gives a kind of a new meaning, in a sense, to the Buddhist idea of, you know, what do you do before enlightenment? Chop wood, carry water. What do you do afterwards? Chop wood, carry water. Right? That bills still need to be paid. Right? So I'm curious about this. How should I refer to this? Is a worldwide pan-Eurasian?
Well, possibly worldwide, but the topic of my book is more connecting Asia and Europe, and to some degree the Middle East as well, because the Western alchemical tradition came more out of Egypt and Greece, and later from the Arabs.
Right.
That's the Western alchemical tradition, and it's all mixed. I mean, the whole Western esoteric tradition is a mixed bag.
Right.
You've got Kabbalistic aspects that are mixed with a much earlier, to me, possibly Sumerian, Babylonian, Egyptian mysticism, and they were fully aware of this internal alchemy. I just want to emphasize that this is an internal alchemy. This is a psychophysiological alchemy that actually transforms the human body to be able to contain, to be able to handle the amperage, the voltage of cosmic consciousness. You cannot plug a hairdryer directly into a nuclear power plant. And so that in the same way, you know, if you just start out say, I'm going to merge with God, you know, I mean, who has the power capacity to handle that? So we work with the angels, archangels, the archai, the seraphim, until we build our power capacity to be able to handle the voltage of cosmic consciousness. That's how yoga came about. This is how Tai Chi, Qigong, everything is about preparing the body to be able to merge with higher and higher states of cosmic consciousness. Once you do that, once you develop that, and you're actually, your internal circuitry changes, then miracles start to happen around you. Healings start to happen around you. Your divinations just start to flow out of your mouth. The past, the present, the future is all happening simultaneously, and you're able to function even across multiple incarnations. Ram Dass once said to me, sometimes I'm not even sure which incarnation I'm in. So this is an awareness of being incarnated in different time periods, but ultimately it's all happening simultaneously in non-linear consciousness.
Yeah, I've heard that idea, similar ideas like that before. And I think, let me check my notes here. At the end, you refer to this as kind of what you said, the multi-incarnational consciousness, right?
Yeah.
And that's going to be, you're going to go into more details in the next book on that one.
Yes.
Yeah. See, I want to talk about the next book. I think that's...
This book pretty much reveals the Philosopher's Stone. Yeah. I think that's pretty good for the first volume.
Oh, yeah. Well, I enjoyed it because, I guess, in my own research, I mean, and this is one of the differences is that, and it kind of frustrates me a little bit, and it's just my personal frustration, that I've spent like the past 30 years in the academic study, but not the practice of things. You know, I try to meditate and do some yoga and whatnot, but it's different, you know, when you actually have that practice there. But I've been thinking, you know, because you can only do so much research without starting to
get these glimpses of, huh, I wonder if these things are connected. Because typically we don't make the connections to a lot of the different traditions and the different practices, but yet there are some commonalities. And this isn't saying that all religions say the same thing. I don't like that idea because they don't all say the same thing. But there does seem to be this interconnected tradition that is hidden in many ways. And, you know, I started piecing these things together when I started asking these questions about, you know, like, well, you know, Hermeticism and Gnosticism and seeing, you know, how this emerged. I do actually have to pause real quick. Hold on.
I'll fill up my teacup. Just a moment. I can't hear you. You're muted.
Oh, no, I just wasn't talking.
Oh.
I was just waiting. Yeah, sorry about that. I forgot to plug the computer in, and I got the low battery notice, so I would have lost you. Yeah, yeah, so I had to plug it in real quick.
Oh, that's a good idea. I got some work.
Yeah. So I was thinking about all these, like, connection similarities, and I also saw the shamanic. And I've been kind of arguing for a long time that I feel that the shamanic is kind of the religion in a sense. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. And in my previous book, Sky Shamans of Mongolia, Michael Harnert talked about it as being the earliest expression of human spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
Going back probably at least 100,000 years, but probably going back to what we might call human beings.
Right.
There was always some form of shamanism. And the shamans were the intermediaries between the spiritual world and what we might call ordinary reality. So that's been around for a long time. In that sense, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, they're newborn babies compared to shamanism.
Yeah.
It's just that we don't have clear records going back, you know, to 5,000 years ago, 8,000 years ago, pre-Ice Age. We really don't have records. We can only assume that. But
yeah.
I was going to say what you previously talked about is that your academic studies, see, you are building an intention.
Yeah.
And this is going to unfold for you in time. It may be a few incarnations. But, you know, you're building an intention. The interest now, what you investigate, what you intend, is going to carry over. And so hopefully in this life you can be liberated in this life. If not, then from an early age, 3, 4, 5 years old, those things are going to start to unfold.
Yeah.
And I have some sympathy because I spent probably my previous three incarnations doing a lot of academic work.
Yeah.
And so in this one, it just hit me right away at 4 years old.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's hope. hope.
I'm not sure I'll be a finished project in this incarnation either.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I'm ever going to be a finished project. I don't know.
Yeah.
Not yet. Yeah, it was interesting because someone else who's kind of touched upon this a little bit is Peter Kingsley. And you mentioned in the book, Abaris, And I read his book, A Story Waiting to Pierce You. And his writing is interesting because
it's Sky Shamans.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems to me that he writes in a way that you actually have to like read between the lines often. But, you know, it does seem like there is this tradition that comes from the, you know, the Mongolians, the Mongolian area, and made its way down to Greece. And I don't know about the connections with India or China, how that would have flown, you know, traveled.
I talk quite a bit about it in this book right here, Sky Shamans of Mongolia.
Okay.
Maybe we can do another talk on that one.
Yeah, I'll have to get a copy of that. And I'm very interested in that as well. Yeah, so, you know, I was trying to piece together, you know, this like shamanism and how it has translated into the various traditions. And it's fairly easy to see in what we call Hinduism and Buddhism. But my question was always, well, where was it in the Western tradition? Why did it seem to not be present there?
It was.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. There was a Celtic shamanism, definitely. Mm-hmm. There was an Indo-European shamanism. Mm-hmm. And I suspect it was all over Europe. But
that was
threatened by spiritual autonomy.
Yeah.
This is one of Michael Herner's terms that he used. Mm-hmm. And spiritual autonomy is not something that religious power structures appreciate.
Right.
They want to stamp that out right away.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I said the Western, I guess I was thinking more along the lines of like the Jewish and Christian and to some aspect Islamic traditions. And, you know, the closest you can get, it seemed like you mentioned Kabbalah and maybe the prophets, possibly.
Well, and the prophets of the Abrahamic religions were definitely, shamans, mystics, yogis. And I think they had a lot of cross-fertilization with Persia, India, Egypt, Sumeria, Babylonia. I think that there was an esoteric, a hidden tradition through all of that.
Mm.
And so those early prophets, to me, they were shamans. They were yogis of the Abrahamic religions. Unfortunately, what happened with the Abrahamic religions was later there became this very split, right, wrong, good, bad. You know, East Asia doesn't have that as much. I mean, it's more relativity and among Hinduism, Buddhism, and so there's a lot less violence. There's religious wars are almost unknown in East Asia, and yet among Abrahamic religions, religious wars are constant.
Yeah,
we're right, they're wrong. We're chosen, they're not. I mean, you know, we have the only prophet. It goes on and on. I mean, this absolutism of the Middle Eastern religions is very unfortunate because I don't think the early prophets were like that at all.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, probably not. And I know that the patriarchs were most likely kind of polytheistic and very connected like to the Canaanite tradition and connected to some of the other traditions in the area. But it's a different idea of God. I mean, when we look at the biblical God, that's quite different than the gods of India. And, you know, in Buddhism, there really isn't a god. You can make the case that in Mahayana and Vajrayana, they do have deities. And you can have wrathful deities, but it's not quite the same kind of divinity that you're working with.
You really go back. I mean, El means God, but Elohim means God's creator.
Right,
gods.
Right, right.
In that sense, to me, the earliest part of the Abrahamic religions was almost identical to Hinduism. Its creator gods created this world. Mm. So there's a multiplicity.
Yeah.
It's not to say a unity didn't exist. It's just from the beginning, the gods created the world. Elohim, plural.
Yeah. 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 And a lot of people don't know that. It's in Genesis 1, where God actually speaks in the plural when creating man and woman.
You find that in any esoteric tradition. There's always a hierarchy of spirits. Yeah. So in Hinduism, you've got the unity. In Taoism, then the unity splits into duality. And then the duality splits into the Trinity, the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost. You have Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. And then from there on, it goes down to the seraphim, down to the archai, to the archangels, to the angels. Mm-hmm. And so the prophets, the messiahs, the saints and sages, the shamans, they've been merging their consciousness with these hierarchies of intelligences throughout history. And but people just have lost the understanding of this because they don't practice. This is why, you know, I teach shamanism. I don't teach Taoism. I don't teach Kriya Yoga. I practice Kriya Yoga, but I don't teach it. You'll have to go to someone else to get initiation. But I write a lot about it.
Right.
Because to me, Kriya Yoga is the essence of the real alchemical, the inner alchemy, that is more accessible. Now, the Chinese alchemists have been doing this all along. It hasn't been hidden. But about 150 years ago in the Himalayan tradition, Babaji brought this out and gave it to Lahiri Mahasaya, who then spread it through. Actually, Lahiri Mahasaya had many disciples. There was only one of them, but he was sort of the most famous one because of Yogananda and later Hariharananda. Now, my teacher, Hariharananda, was 20 years younger than Yogananda. And Yogananda went to the States in 1920. Yogananda took initiation from Sri Yukteswar in 1932. And then he went and lived in the ashram from 1938. And 10 years later, he achieved Nirvikalpa Samadhi, so breathless, pulseless state, kind of a permanent merging in the Godhead. And so he was, in a sense, the last living in that lineage, a real Paramahansa that I know of. There are some others who might call themselves His Holiness or Paramahansas. I don't know. I cannot say. But as far as I know, Hariharananda was the last in that lineage. And his Mahasamadhi was in 2003.
Okay. I think. All right.
He lived to be 95, whereas Ananda Mahasamadhi at 59. That was pretty early.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a Babaji ashram in southern Colorado.
Well, there's a lot of Babajis popping up, like toads. I don't know if that is really the original lineage that Lahiri Mahasaya talked about. I don't know. I'm not in a position to judge.
Yeah, yeah. I don't remember this story. I've visited it a few times. And they don't have anyone there, as far as I know, that's like a guru. They seem to be more involved in karma yoga, just kind of work and service, but in dedication to Babaji.
It's a good start.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, building the power of trajectory.
Yeah.
Nothing is lost. I mean, any good works that we've done, any positive intentions, it carries over. I mean, all of this emanates, resonates out into the universe. And so, you know, step by step, drop by drop, the pool fills.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you said this, and I have a quote from the book, and this kind of harkens back to something that you just said. And it's, despite a long history of worldwide esoteric knowledge and tradition, most of us from industrialized countries have lost this connection to living lineages, and our cultural mythos no longer lives through us. As a Westerner, I wished for a rich spiritual heritage like that of India and a rebirth of a Western esoteric heritage. And that really resonated with me because it seems as if the traditions that we have, there's something profoundly lacking in them in terms of the experiences. You know, it seems like, you know, occasionally someone can have kind of an experience. And I think that there are exceptions. I don't want to just kind of wipe it all away. You know, one exception perhaps that comes to mind that seems to be fairly shamanic is Pentecostalism, where people are having these ecstatic experiences in church.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. It's quite shamanic. But in the Western tradition, probably Daskalos on Cyprus was one of the most recent Christian mystics. He was apparently able to, you know, simultaneously recall his former lives and even speak the languages, the archaic dialects, and even read and write some of them.
Wow.
While he was still alive, and to do healing on a level that we normally don't hear of outside of East Asia or India or the Sufis in Persia. So this tradition has been alive, but the problem with the West is that it's not very accepting. So the Sufis have kind of a strict rule that you don't show off, you don't perform too many miracles, because that kind of thing gets you staked up to a tree somewhere, because the power structures don't like seeing too much, of their scene blown up,
right?
Especially in the West. So if you walk down the street performing miracles right and left in India, they all come out, with the flowers and everything. And next thing you know, you've got an ashram and students. But if you walk down the street performing miracles in Europe,
yeah.
You may end up in a mental institution or locked up or who knows. So the culture, as sophisticated as Europe is in many ways, really has not flowered esoterically. And so I'm hoping that this book that I just wrote is going to connect and reconnect, because to me, what the Rosicrucians were teaching, the early alchemists, yeah. they actually knew a version of Kriya Yoga. And it's not because they passed notes to each other, but because this is an internal psychophysiological process that is natural to any human being and could happen on any continent, even independently. So, there are some scholarly debates about how did shamanism spread around the world. And some right. people think that, oh, it started somewhere in Central Asia after the Ice Age and spread out. But I would say no. I would say even the most, any human being could be initiated by the spirits directly at any time in any culture, no matter how separated from the group. So this is where anthropologists are still thinking about religion. And shamanism yeah. is not a religion. It's not an ism. It's a methodology for working practically, for actually operating in spiritual realities. It does not require a belief system.
Right.
And so to me, shamanism just flowered, appeared. Anytime that a person, no matter how far away, they could be on Easter Island, totally separated, almost totally from everyone, but they have a near-death experience. They meet the spirits. They realize there are objective spiritual realities, and they come back and they start to do healing. They start doing divination. So this could happen to anyone, anytime. And in fact, probably at the hospital down the street from your house, someone is having a near-death experience right now and learning about the spirits, learning about the afterlife, learning about spiritual dimensions, objective spiritual realities, and they're going to come back changed. And who knows, they might start doing healing or who yeah. knows what. They might turn into, Johnny Smith, the dead zone, and
start oh, yeah.
become yeah. a psychometric.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I like that because, coming from the academic perspective, that is what we do. We're like, well, there has to be a chain here somewhere, lineage that we can follow. Well, it came from, it started here and then moved here and then here and then here. And that's why I was stumbling a little bit earlier when I was talking about kind of like in the, I guess in the Abrahamic traditions, but then it's in India too. How did, is there a connection? Did they get there? And it doesn't necessarily have to be no. that. Yeah.
Oh, that's the materialist point of view.
Yeah.
That's like neurologists trying to figure out how do chemical and electrical impulses in the brain produce consciousness? That's the right. wrong question.
Yeah.
It's rather, how is the brain receiving consciousness from a field of consciousness, which yeah. the ancients, the shamans always knew, the ancient Hindus always knew, the ancient Taoists always knew, that we are receiving our perceptions from a field of consciousness that we can call Brahma, we can call it whatever. It's interesting that Brahma is quite close to Abraham,
yeah.
I find that quite curious, but that may be where the Tengars were connected. This is the Central Asian religion where the Tengars and the shamans came into a melange, a mix. The Tengars were the Tingris of ancient Sumeria. They were called the sky gods. In other words, I think it was just a term for higher dimensional consciousness beings, frequencies of consciousness that we can actually tune to. Now, because we're humans, we want to relate to a personality.
Yeah.
And so those frequencies of consciousness then appear to us as deities, as gods, as angels, but they're far beyond any kind of form. But that's the easiest way for us to relate to them. And then, unfortunately, as Michael Harner used to say, you know, religion begins when the last shaman dies, because then it's no longer living. You see, shamanism is living.
Right.
They're actually communicating directly with these intelligences, as were the prophets and the messiahs of the old traditions. But then when, you know, the prophets don't have any students who can contain, have the power capacity to contain that level of cosmic consciousness, then the living thread is lost and people have only old stories. And somebody says, well, let's write these old stories down. And then some king says, gosh, we got all these old stories. Scholars, why don't you get together and put all these old stories into a book? And then I can present this packaged new religion to the community, because I want to fight that group over there and I need everybody on the same page.
Yeah.
And then we have religion, you know. And our spirits are better than their spirits.
Yeah. Yeah, it's religion is, yeah.
Has a few problems.
Yeah, religion is a little freaky at times, I think. And I appreciate the experiential aspect to shamanism. Before I hit record, I was explaining that I had gone through Michael Harner's intro to shamanism training, and apparently you were there. Which is a nice little maybe synchronicity of sorts. I don't know. I said maybe it's a nice little synchronicity of sorts. I don't know. But yeah, I had a really interesting experience during that it's not that I tried to explain it, because it's like, well, I had the experience. And, you know, I've had people try to explain it away and try to explain away a lot of experiences that I've had. And, you know, my response is always, but you don't know, you weren't there, you didn't have the experience. But it seems to me that there is this rising interest in the shamanic by people in the West, because I think that it does speak to something that they long for. I've published almost 200 episodes of this podcast, so I've talked to a lot of people. And I've talked to some people who've been trained in shamanism and worked with various shamans. And one of the common themes that keeps coming up is this idea that humanity needs to remember who they are. We need to remember who we are. And I always take that to a shamanic aspect, where you were talking earlier about the initiation of dismemberment. And that's how I kind of think about remember. It's like, okay, we have gone through this process of division.
Right.
And now we need to bring ourselves together. We need to literally remember ourselves.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Some people can say that all spirituality is a process of remembering. I mean, the unity has divided into the plurality. And then at a certain point, we start to remember the unity. And then we want to start moving back toward the unity. So it's really a remembering process.
Yeah.
Sometimes we get into a sort of competitive, like the race to enlightenment, me first, get out of my way.
Yeah.
And that's not exactly the process. It's more of a going backwards. It's a going in. Yeah. It's a returning to where we came from. So it's not so much of a grasping or an achieving. It might feel like that in the beginning, but it's more of a return and a remembrance.
Yeah.
As the Hindus say, we are all God, but we forgot.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that what enlightenment is then? A remembering of who we really are?
Well, I mean, there are many definitions of enlightenment. To be filled with light would suggest that you have increased your power capacity. When I say power, I'm talking about spiritual vitality here. Mm. You've increased your power capacity so that you can hold a very high frequency of light. Mm. And at that point, it changes your, actually at a cellular level, it changes you. And so this is why Yogananda's body did not decay after death. and why some saints are found in the state of incorruptibility, because they've actually transmuted their physical cells into such a high frequency of light and brought that light into such a dense form that their bodies actually do not decay. Now, we, a materialist might say, well, that's just not possible. But so you see, from another point of view, is this is all consciousness. This is all a kind of dream.
Right.
We've simply dream densified the dream again and again and again, and we dream within a dream within a dream until suddenly this feels so solid and real that we've forgotten that it's just part of the dream. So the saints and the sages, they're able to alter physical reality immediately, or sometimes slowly, depends on the level of development, the level of circuitry upgrades they have received. In fact, the power of a shaman is often rated by how many dismemberments they've had. So in a sense, you could say how many upgrades you've had. What's interesting, though, is externally, you look exactly the same as anyone else.
Right.
So you could have Obi-Wan Kenobi or a saint or a sage going through the market with nothing but a robe on, and nobody even notices them go by until somebody says, hey, my disease disappeared. What happened? Well, they passed within the consciousness field of a being who can contain that much realization of the dream, and their illnesses, their disharmonies disappeared. So this is in India called darshan. You go sit in the consciousness field of a saint who is able to hold that state where they know this is a dream. They don't just think it's a dream. They know it's a dream. And when you enter into that consciousness field, any disharmonies start to disappear. Now, many of us, though, when we come close to a saint, we want to run away because our identity is melting away the moment we come close to them. So that's, you know, many people go back and forth to India. Oh, I'm going to see my guru. But after a few weeks with the guru, it's like, oh, my God, this bonfire is cooking me to pieces, and they have to run away.
Yeah.
Same with psychedelics. Many people take psychedelics and they contact, they have a remembrance of cosmic consciousness. They have a remembrance of the great dream of the Godhead. But then the drug wears off. And it's like, oh, shit, I'm getting hungry. I got to go pay taxes. There's mosquitoes bugging me. And they're back to this ordinary reality with all its problems.
Yeah.
So they go and take it again to remember.
Yeah.
Problem is it doesn't transform you. It just gives you a visit.
Right. Yeah. Well, with the psychedelics, there's, especially when it's used in a therapeutic kind of setting, a major component of that is integration, that you have to do work afterwards. And it seems like from a spiritual perspective, going to see a guru, that the people who flee because they can't, you know, handle it so much, that they also need to do a kind of integration.
Yes, absolutely. And that's described in my book, and how I failed so many times because I couldn't integrate the power that, that the states of consciousness. And I was only in my 20s and 30s at the time. So, I mean, I was full of piss and vinegar. I was a young guy then.
Well, the spiritual path is not for weaklings. It's, you know, it's
indeed.
Yeah, it takes a lot of courage. And
well, I teach Michael Harner's 3-year program in advanced shamanic initiations. I teach mostly at Bali, Indonesia, but I also teach in Thailand, Taiwan, and other places. Just recently taught in Cambodia near Angkor Wat.
Wow.
But the 3-year program is actually 6 weeks spread over 3 years. And so we need that integration. Dr. Harner used to teach that in 30 days. He took the whole 6 weeks and pressed it into 30 days, but people had no time to integrate.
Yeah.
So they were, some folks were literally going off and like swinging in the trees, you know, after after that 30 days. So with 3 years, we have, you know, time to integrate. And a new one is beginning end of October in Bali, Indonesia. Mm-hmm.
All right. Wonderful. We'll get to that, where people can go and find out more about that at the end of the conversation. Let me think here for a second of what I wanted to ask you next, though. I kind of got sidetracked in my head. Oh, sorry, I have allergies too. My eye itching. I'm going to.
There's a mantra for that.
For allergies?
There's a mantra for everything.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, gurus are something that we don't really have in the West so much. And I think there's often a mistrust because there have been some very negative experiences, historically speaking, with gurus in the Western world. And what I was wanting to comment on, what I was trying to remember, was that, you know, the truly enlightened guru, you know, you said that, you know, you might walk by them in the grocery store and never notice anything. But I wondered, well, is that really true? Because when you met like Hari Harananda, you noticed something right away that seemed to suggest that he was the real deal.
Yes. Well, I also met him in an ashram, and I had an intention to go there to meet him.
Yeah.
And I heard that he was the most highly developed Kriya Yogi in the world after Yogananda and Sri Yukteswar. So I had a clear intention. I was just meaning, speaking generally, a saint or a sage could walk through a busy marketplace and people might not notice who they are. I do recall I was in the Himalayas hiking and a Tibetan yogi came walking down and his aura was just magnificent. I mean, his rainbow body was going out like 5 meters around him.
Wow.
And I immediately did this, but he looked like just almost a beggar.
Yeah.
But he was not. And then he looked at me with eyes that just pierced to my soul. And he just said, okay. In English. And not Ate, you know, as might be Hindi or something else or Tibetan. And the voice, the vibration of his okay, just was like wave over me. But had I been chatting with someone else, I would have never noticed it. He would have gone right over by.
Wow. Okay.
But I would say in the West, we do have this. And I would say that Ezekiel, Elijah, Elias, Jesus, John the Baptist, these beings are living. Their consciousness is still alive. So they can be your guru. They can be your teacher. And if you really merge your consciousness with the early prophets like Elijah, Elias, then, I mean, that's absolutely living to me. And so it's not gone. I would say none of the traditions are gone. In fact, even the Mithraic tradition, which people say has disappeared in the astral realm or the causal realm, it has not. It is very much alive, and that will be in the next volume.
Okay.
So the West has not lost touch with this, but one good thing is through shamanism and learning shamanic journeying, as well as esoteric practices in the Tibetan system, Vajrayana and Kriya Yoga are very similar. In fact, it's one of the reasons that I left the Tibetan Vajrayana, because I found that Kriya Yoga was actually the essence of Vajrayana practice. And I was tired of chasing lamas all over the Himalayas.
Yeah.
Because I had already been initiated into the higher Kriyas. And I thought, well, why am I running around to get this, you know, graduated system from the Tibetans, which took years and years and years, but I had already received it from Hari Harananda, who received it from Sri Yukteswar. So, you know, I mean, Hari Harananda told me in 1996, Sri Yukteswar did not give this out. But I will give it to you. Because this is the scientific age. This is the time to reveal this. So we are mature enough now in human society and human consciousness to begin to practice this. So I believe, in fact, that the Rosicrucians, even Rudolf Steiner and the Kriya lineage, at some level, they were working from the same impulse. They were working from the same. I mean, the Kali Yuga ended in 1899, according to Sri Yukteswar. And the Rosicrucians have exactly the same date, totally independently, 1899. And it was Sri Yukteswar who actually corrected the Yuga mathematical calculations to come up with the Kali Yuga ending in 1899, which the Rosicrucians had been saying at quite an early date. And so we're talking about a consciousness impulse, two very separate places.
Yeah.
But there's an acknowledgement, even though we had two world wars afterwards, you know, we're very much leaving the Kali Yuga. Things are getting better. There's hope. Mm. And so one of the reasons I wrote this book was because I felt like I just cannot leave this world without telling this story.
Yeah.
And I feel like Yogananda's work, as fabulous as it is being forgotten.
Mm.
And Kriya Yoga has become kind of watered down and spread out to such a degree that people don't really know what being around Yogananda was like.
Right.
And so I told the story of being around Hariharananda, the last living disciple of Sri Yukteswar. So Sri Yukteswar is my param guru, my guru's guru. So I had to tell this story. I'll be 64 at the end of this summer. And I was like, I had to tell this story before I leave here so that it can revive, but also connect that there is right. a pan-Eurasian tradition. Now, I cannot really speak directly about Africa, South America, or the Mayans. I'm assuming they had some similar practices, but the Eurasian one is the old one that we know of, at least since the last ice age.
Yeah. Yeah. Where my research took me was the Neoplatonist in theurgy. And I saw that as being very shamanic.
Plotinus.
Plotinus and Iamblichus, all those fellows. The question, though, is with the yoga, I understand that yoga really was introduced to the West by Vivekananda around 1893, I think it was, at the Chicago. 1895. Right, at the World's Fair.
Master to speak in the West.
Yeah.
There's a very fascinating connection between him and Yogananda.
Yeah, okay.
That's separated by 30 or 40 years.
Hmm. Okay. When
Vivekananda gave the speech in 1895, or before he did, there was a poster of him on the wall saying he was going to speak. Hmm. And there was a 12-year-old boy walking down the street in Chicago with his mother. The moment he saw Vivekananda's poster, he said, "I have to go see him." Hmm. And the mother said, "What are you talking about? Who's this strange brown man from India?" I mean, 1895, no one knew anything about Hinduism or India. But the boy insisted. This is a 12-year-old in Chicago in 1895. So the mother takes him there because he's dragging his mom to get him there. And after the talk, the boy just runs up to Vivekananda and says, "You're my teacher. You're my guru." Vivekananda says, "No, no, but your teacher will come and he will give you a silver cup." Now, jump 30 years. The guy's now 40 or so. And he meets Yogananda. He takes Kriya Yoga initiation. He's practicing. And then Yogananda goes back to India for a year to see his guru before he departs. And when he returns, Yogananda brings him a silver cup and gives it to him. And then he cries and he says, "I've been waiting 40 years for that cup.
Wow.
Now I know." And Vivekananda had the consciousness to be able to perceive 30 to 40 years in the future on the spot.
Yeah.
Just as he's talking to this 12-year-old boy, that he can perceive Yogananda's giving him a cup 30 or 40 years in the future. Now that's a state of consciousness that's quite a high capacity to hold consciousness.
Yeah.
And that's really at a whole nother level than what we're normally accustomed to. He didn't get out a drum. He didn't get out rattles, you know, to say, "I'm going to do a divination and, oh, I see decades in the future, you know, this brown man is going to give you a silver cup." You know, he just, bam, right there.
Yeah. Yeah. You had a lot of stories like that in the book as well with Hariharananda, who knew things about you.
Yeah. Oh, he knew all about my life.
Oh, yeah.
It was quite embarrassing.
Yeah. Yeah. I would find it pretty disconcerting if someone knew everything that I was up to. Probably
looking through my eyes, you know. Yeah. Well, that's what a real teacher is, you know. It is, you know, a granting of emerging with consciousness. It is a resonation to a higher degree. But we could have teachers that are non-incarnate. Many of my teachers, in fact, most of my teachers now do not have physical bodies. They are in higher dimensions, and I can connect to them directly. So I don't have to go running around the Himalayas anymore. Everybody asks me, Kevin, aren't you going back to the Himalayas? Oh, aren't you going back to those shamans? And I say, I can connect to them anytime.
The reason I brought up Vivekananda, though, and I knew that Yogananda followed, you know, not too long after, that there was this initial introduction of yoga to the West, but somehow along the way, it ended up being all about getting bendy.
Right.
And I'm really curious, and I know this is outside of the scope of the book, but I'm curious if you have any thoughts or insight as to why yoga got, I guess, so commercialized, maybe?
This is always the tendency for an esoteric practice to become exoteric at a later time. This is a tendency of, you can call it Ahrimanic forces, but that the consciousness forces that are actually pulling us to the material. So this is why you have living shamanism, living saints and sages, and it devolves into a religion and a belief system,
right,
which suddenly has all this dogmas and guilt and shame and blah, 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 which is to me a devolution of true spirituality. Although sometimes the stories can be inspiring, so at least there's something there. And be good and you'll be all right after you die. That kind of thing for religion is the positive aspect. But the same thing with yoga. I mean, Yogananda came exactly 25 years after Vivekananda to the West, and he stayed for the rest of his life. And so there's this constant pull back to the material. And so you even see it among, you know, even so-called spiritual scientists that, you know, they start getting pulled back to the material, pulled back to the material. So this is something of, I won't say it's a natural process, but the whole process of alchemy is becoming less material. As we become less material and we remember who we are, I mean, Ramana Maharishi said, you know, just meditate and ask, who am I, and keep peeling back the layers. And suddenly you come into this spaciousness, this all-pervading awareness that is beyond any kind of identification, beyond any kind of egoic identification.
Yeah. Yeah. The other trajectory in my research, not just the theurgy and Neoplatonism, but also where I saw connections was in the Western magical traditions.
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem with the Western magical traditions, and I'm not an expert in that field, is a lot of it has to do with what Michael Horner might call middle world shamanism. In other words, a kind of sorcery, sort of to get what you want. In the world. And some, I mean, Western magical traditions will just blatantly admit that. Yeah, I'm practicing magic to get what I want. And so if you want to take the more mystical point of view, that's not very compassionate.
Right.
And so it's lacking the compassion. And see, that's the problem with middle world magic or middle world shamanism as well, is it's lacking the compassion. For example, Michael Horner used to talk about dueling tribes or warring tribes in the Amazon. They would, both of the tribes would drink ayahuasca and go out of their bodies and try to kill each other. Now, what kind of spirit supports that kind of violence? So that's not an all-compassionate spirit. And that's one of the reasons Michael gave up on ayahuasca. Ultimately, you may learn a lot from it. You may even get some healing from it. But ultimately, it's a middle world spirit. It's not all compassionate. So the spirits of the transcendent realms, they are all compassionate. They are looking at the big picture. They're not ethnocentric, which would be only compassionate to their group, their tribe. So one of the problems with the esoteric magical traditions, especially coming out of the West, is they tend to be very ethnocentric and lineage focused. And so I think the Harry Potter series kind of describes this a bit well. You have the secret magical families, and then you have everybody else, which are called muggles.
Right.
All this is an old tradition of holding back esoteric knowledge for me and mine. I'm only going to give it to my family because we're special, we're better, or whatever. This is lacking in compassion. And so I'm trying to emphasize, and Michael Harner emphasized in his work, compassion, compassion, compassion. So teaching compassionate shamanism for healing, for divination, for the big picture. Not only one group of people, not only one perspective. Sorry, I'm just rambling on here.
Oh no, that's okay. It's quite interesting, and I appreciate all of it. And I told you that it gets difficult sometimes the longer we go with these things. But let me ask this question, and we'll kind of start wrapping up here. So shamanism is becoming more popular. Ayahuasca is becoming more popular. And people don't always necessarily embrace the shamanic when they take the medicine. Sometimes they're just taking the medicine. And hopefully there's integration. But shamanism has become fairly popular in some ways.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, you know, and I had mentioned that, you know, so many of my guests have said, we need to remember who we are. We need to remember who we are. Is consciousness or Brahman, however you want to phrase this, are we being led or kind of nudged to, you know, humanity in general towards this, to perhaps help save ourselves and possibly help save the planet as well?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
I believe so. And we're going to go through many bumps and people are going to be attracted to different things. I mean, I teach in Bali, Indonesia, and they've got shamanic tantra and shamanic Reiki and Reiki Dolphin Mystery School Tantra. I mean, it's just exploding. And most of these teachers, unfortunately, I would call them under-initiated.
Yeah.
They are lacking direct connection.
Yeah. To spirit.
But they had an opening and they want to spread it. So the intention is that they want to be part of the awakening process. But of course, we're going to have some under-trained persons introducing these things. But hey, you know, people get their start somewhere. I mean, my first Tai Chi teacher, you know, was just a guy who learned from another guy. And later I could meet a Tai Chi master. And so we got to get started somewhere.
Right, right. Yeah. And the initiation seems to be what's really kind of crucial in many ways. And that's central to your book because you're describing a series of initiations in here. Because that's something that we don't really have a lot of, especially in the West, is initiations.
All right. Well, that was one of the reasons why I had to publish the book. And I've been working on it for a while, from 15 years of journals.
Wow.
Part two's in the works, because a lot of this has been lost.
Yeah.
And as Sri Yukteswar said, the time of secrecy is coming to an end.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we need it, it seems to me, right now, because materialism, I think, has been kind of shown to be false. And it was interesting because I have a similar, if not the same, idea of consciousness, that I don't accept that the brain creates it, but that it's a kind of a receiver for consciousness. And I reject materialism a lot. But then you caught me when I was talking about this aspect of academics, and you're like, well, that's kind of from a materialist point of view. And I'm like, you know, he's right. And it seems to me that that's one of the things that I personally have to work on is, you know, just this other ways that materialism seeps into the worldview and speaks to the world, you know, how we see and act in the world. So now I have to do some deep reflection on that.
You know, Yogananda said a very interesting thing in private conversations. This was not in his autobiography, but other ones. He said he used to believe that darkness or dark forces was just ignorance. But then he said, later I came to realize there actually are forces, what I call the middle world, or Dr. Harner calls the middle world, that are trying to hold human souls to Earth. And this goes along quite in a similar way with Rudolf Steiner, who talked about Ahrimanic forces who want to hold human consciousness down to machines. which actually reduces our consciousness.
Right.
We are, in a sense, taking it a level further down into materialism, into alternate virtual realities, which is actually going to be more of a loss. We're going to get more lost. We are dream densifying into a virtual reality. Some people are already doing nothing but sitting at home hooked up like you are with your headphones, you know.
Yeah.
But if we can use the technology while still remaining awake and not be slaves to it, to our phones. I mean, I see everyone doing this all the time.
Yeah.
And they're out of contact with the spirits of the trees right around them. And they're just lost in this machine. It's a perfect description of human consciousness being held to a machine. Use the machine. It's convenient. It's quick, saves time. And then back to this life and then to the spiritual life. But I think it is possible to incorporate even technology because it's part of the dream too. And in fact, Samuel Sagan did a fascinating thing. He was actually able to put consciousness into his website. And the vibration of the consciousness could come out of his website. And in a sense, everything we do, including the books we write, what we say, all our being is resonating with our state of consciousness. So what we do, what we say, what we write, what we paint, the music we play, is all resonating a particular state of consciousness.
Yeah.
Things will get better. There is hope.
Good. I hope so. I hope I do. I hope that there is hope. But yeah, I agree with everything you just said. And I was just thinking how when the internet first became very popular, there were, this blizzard of books about them, but quite often, and it's not just unique to the internet and computers, but throughout our history with machines, one of the analogies, probably the most common analogy, was almost always a religious kind of analogy. Like one of the books I've got, I forget the author's name, Wertheimer, I think, is The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace. And I thought, well, that's really interesting because it could work both ways. And one, it seems like there's a making this spiritual thing concrete. But the other aspect, like you were just saying, is it can actually perhaps help liberate us from the material at the same time.
In terms of saving us time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just like tractors. I mean, it used to be that 98% of the world was out in the fields.
Yeah.
With the invention of the tractor, it could do all the farm work. And then we have some free time to read books and talk and play music together, to hang out, to philosophize. Without the tractor, man, we'd all be out there 14 hours a day in the fields. Yeah. So, technology is certainly not a bad thing. In fact, it's an outflow of our DNA. It's a part of the evolution. But we don't want to make AI or your calculator or our computers the master. The soul is driving the car, soul-directed life. That's the shamanic life.
Yeah.
And then we've got these tools that we can use to make everything faster, give us more free time. But people are getting lost. Their consciousness is actually contracting rather than expanding.
Yeah.
People are even having less free time because they're doing this all day long. But, with everything, we go through a period of darkness. Anytime a new technology came in, think about it. It was usually immediately misused. So dictators and emperors, the moment a new technology, gunpowder, whatever, came about, rather than using it for something positive, it was immediately military, atomic power. The moment we had atomic power, what did we do? Bam, two bombs on Japan, and huge missiles. So, step by step,
they are
evolving.
I hope. So let me ask you, you've mentioned the new book and you've mentioned a training that begins in October in Bali. What else have you got going on?
Well, I teach constantly for the Foundation for Shamanic Studies. I'm the director for Asia. So I don't teach in Europe or America because there are FSS America, FSS Europe, FSS South America as well, Latin America in Spanish. But I teach all over Asia. So I teach two-day courses, an eight-day course series where people can go deep into shamanic work, deep into shamanic healing, deep into shamanic divination. And I think that is a partially a process of remembering who we are. But it's again, it's not a religion. It's learning practical, operational methodologies for working in spiritual realities. It's nothing to do with belief systems. You don't have to believe anything. And in fact, belief can be even counterproductive. It would be better just to remain open to possibilities.
Yeah.
And then when you are shown the evidence, as I like to often say, the proof is in the pudding. You can't just read the recipe. You can't chant the recipe. You can't memorize the recipe. It's not going to make the pudding. You got to do the pudding. And when it tastes good, you've got the results. So when you get the results from healing, from divination, you know it's accurate. You know that it's useful. You know that it's practical. You don't need to believe in pudding. You can taste it.
Yeah.
So I teach in Bali most of the time, and I have courses in Bali most of the year. And it's slightly below the equator. So there, the northern hemisphere winter is their summer, vice versa. Only slightly below the equator. So August is the coolest time in Bali. And January is the hottest time. So I usually teach in Thailand in January or in Cambodia and March in Taiwan. Just finished classes in Chinese, and I'm starting a new Chinese language 3-year end of September and a new English 3-year. And I have 2 3-years that are finishing up this year and next year. So it's been a busy time.
Yeah, I imagine so. Well, it's nice that you're taking the work of Michael Harner and sharing it with the rest of the world.
Well, I'm just doing what he did in the sense that he took the work of the shamans.
Right.
He distilled it, codified it into what he calls core shamanism, which is the essence of shamanic practice. A lot of people misunderstand that. They think that it's neo-shamanism. But neo-shamanism is where you just borrow stuff. Like, we're going to do a peace pipe. We're going to do a sweat lodge. We're going to chant something from one tribe to another tribe. That's not what he did.
Yeah.
What he did is he took the essence and distilled it, all these practices, and teaches only the practice. So you can build your own shamanic lineage. The spirits can teach you what clothes to wear, what feathers you want to put in your headdress. The spirits can teach you that directly. You don't need somebody to tell you to do that. But if somebody does want to study in a lineage, that's great. I was with Mayan shamans. I've been with Nepalese shamans, Tamang shamans, Tibetan shamans. I was very privileged to be with the last 3 Tibetan shamans. They're all gone now in Nepal. And I was with Mongolian shamans. And of course, I wrote a whole book about that. So the indigenous tribal lineages are fantastic. And I do recommend, if you have the opportunity, to study with them. Unfortunately, not everybody has the time to go live with those groups. So Dr. Harner saved us a lot of time because he did crawl through the mud and the snakes to live with those tribes and be initiated by all those different shamans. And then he academically studied. So he's a rare combination of an Ivy League academic and an actual initiated practicing shaman.
Yeah.
This is something that is very difficult to find. Yeah. I've given talks at academic conferences. For example, in China, I gave 2 talks at an academic conference. And the academics talked about, okay, the shaman did this, the shaman did that, and they said they had 12 feathers in their headdress and they had such and such necklace on. And I'd ask, well, did the client get better after this healing? And they just looked at me like I was crazy. They never thought to ask the question whether the client got better or not. And it's like, well, that's why we do shamanism, is because it works. But to them, it was an academic exercise.
Yeah.
They didn't care whether it worked. It just was something that they could put on their list of academic activities and they could get more grants.
Right.
And so another one came up and said, okay, the shaman did this. They wore this clothes. They sang this song. Here's a photo. They dropped sheep ankle bones in a metal bowl. They did the divination. And then I asked, well, was the divination accurate? They never thought to ask. To them, it's a cultural relic. It's not an actual spiritual practice.
Right.
And so, anyway.
Yeah, no, that's,
that change.
Again, it's what I was saying kind of at the very beginning. From my experiences, there is this division in academia between, you know, kind of explaining this is what's going on, but they often don't give it any kind of credit. And I know that a criticism against Michael Harner would be, you know, well, he went native. That's the way that it would be phrased. It's not a good phrase, but that he did what you're not supposed to do, that he actually began practicing it.
Way native. Okay.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, it seems to me that in order to actually understand and to talk about it, you have to practice it.
Absolutely.
You know,
that's what I argued about, and I argued in Sky Shamans of Mongolia.
Yeah,
the academics cannot possibly understand. They do good records, though.
Oh yeah,
graphic records are great because the practicing shaman can actually look back at those and understand them, whereas the academic probably didn't actually understand.
Right.
But they reported it, and they recorded it. So that's useful. That is actually useful.
Yeah. Yeah. But they leave out a lot, you know, did the divination work, you know,
did the client get better?
Yeah. And probably it's because they didn't think it would work because they're not looking at it as something that is, they see it probably as just like superstition and that it couldn't possibly work. But, well, you know,
the reason shamans have been doing it for thousands of years is precisely because it works.
Yeah.
If it didn't work, no one would go to the shamans.
Right.
Doesn't mean it works 100% of the time. Nothing works 100% of the time. No sports person gets a goal in every game. Nobody makes every basket they shoot. And the same thing if you go to the regular medical hospital. Nobody gets cured of every disease.
Right.
So why should we expect 100% cure rate from a shaman? Of course not. Yeah. But they have consistently shown improvement in their clients over years, and that's why people call them a shaman.
Right.
Because they have a proven track record.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a matter of getting a degree in shamanism from some university, you know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And there are some, very few, but there are some really interesting examples of Western medicine. I don't want to say utilizing shamanic healing, but working kind of hand in hand with shamanic healing. There's a community in California, I think it's in Merced, it's the Hmong. It's a very shamanic culture. And now in the hospitals in Merced, it is not uncommon to see a Hmong shaman there working kind of hand in hand with the Western medical tradition.
Yes, I have actually done shamanic work in Japanese hospitals.
Yeah.
For tribal people in Japan that I knew.
Wow.
And I was in there shaking my rattles and doing shamanic work. And in one case, I knew elder got up and left the hospital the next day and had no trace of cancer. Nothing.
Wow.
Gone.
Wow.
The doctor said, that's not possible. We must have misdiagnosed.
Hmm.
We get no respect, shaman.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe that will change. Maybe that will change. Hopefully that'll change.
Yeah, in a sense, in the early days. I think this is going to take probably a century and a half or so.
Yeah, yeah. I won't be here then. I don't think so.
Well, I won't be either.
Or at least not in this physical.
I'll be back in another form.
Yeah, maybe. All right. Where can people go to find out more about you and your work, Kevin?
www.shamanism-asia.com.
Okay.
www.shamanism-asia.com.
Okay, perfect.
-asia.com. Oh, everything is there. You got to dig in a little bit, got to push buttons. It's not all on the first page.
Yeah.
All right. But it has the schedule, it has information about all kinds of things in there.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I will put that in the show notes in the video description as well as links to your book, so that people can find both of them a little bit easier. And again, I really enjoyed the book and I'm looking forward to the second one. And now I have to get myself a copy of Sky Shamans of Mongolia and read that. So hopefully we can speak again. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Dr. Nick, thank you so much. Good to talk with you.
All right. Thank you.
And that's a wrap on episode 195 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're a part of my YouTube audience. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button. And if you're watching on YouTube, don't forget to subscribe to the channel and click that notification bell. You can also follow Rebel Spirit Radio on whatever audio platform you use for listening to podcasts. Right now, I'm nearing 20,000 downloads on the audio platforms, yet I only have 12 followers, and one of those is me. It only takes a second to like, follow, or subscribe, and it's totally free, and it really does help. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I put a lot of effort and time into each episode, so if you find value in the conversations I provide here, I hope you can find it in your heart to send a little love my way. With more subscriptions and followers, I could possibly get some sponsorship, and honestly, having some funds come my way to help with equipment, hosting, and other necessary subscriptions would be really helpful. You can also help by joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rebelspirit. The link is also in the episode description. You can also buy a super thanks on YouTube to help support my work. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness, and the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to, or watching, Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.